Okay, we're going to. This will be short, for sure. How much time I got?
We have time for this and time for questions.
Yeah.
We have about 40 minutes.
Okay. This is a more recent set of data collected by an organization in Washington, D.C., non-political, Public Religion, what's the name of it?
Religion and Public Life?
No, not them. I know them too. This is called Public Religion Institute or something like that. It's run by a young guy who's very progressive oriented. This was in 2009, so last year. And what we've got here, some very interesting data looking at progressives and conservatives and what are the issue priorities. So, it's interesting to take the issues and see where these two, and these two are just like mirror opposites of one another. If you look at where the priorities are. Poverty was like the number one issue for that would be income inequality, poverty, etc. Homelessness, probably all connected. 74%, roughly three-fourths of the progressives identify, and these are progressive leaders, by the way. This is not general public, whereas that other survey I shared was general public. This is among religious leaders. And you see where that falls out over here. So they are ordered over here. 67% for health care. You see how low it is here. Environment, 56%. Look at that, way down. Jobs, economy, 48. Iraq war, 45. Immigration, 21. Same-sex marriage. Now, these are listed not in terms of yes or no. These are listed in terms of their importance. You got 65% over here of conservatives saying, of course, no to that issue. So this becomes, well, abortion becomes the highest ranked issue for the conservatives, and same-sex marriage is the second highest. And then, I guess, probably, no, immigration would be too. Yes.
What's amazing to me is the jobs economy line, because that became the issue in this last election cycle.
Right.
And it was completely taken over by the more conservative elements.
Yeah.
And yet it's not as strong as that.
And who knows, talk about fluidity, who knows how all of this stuff has changed if we're coming down to the present context, just a year later.
Yeah.
Given the political mood and how it shifted in the country, and the concerns that people raise about Obama's leadership and all the things that are centered around it. Anyway, it's a fascinating set of data. People were also asked how to increase influence. The progressives say we need to be visible, more visible, politically active, focus on pluralism, and civility. we can all agree, but it doesn't fly very well, right? Support separation of church and state. So try to get those in your mind, because the next one I think is on how to increase influence of the conservatives. So visibility, political activity, civility, pluralism. Visibility and political activity, of course. Pray and be active.
Yeah.
Now there, this emphasizes my point. Connect your religion with your ideological persuasion. Pray, but go out there and do something about it on that political issue. Now, progressives do the same thing. Now, I'm not just emphasizing what conservatives do, but this makes the point about how the religion and the religious and the political kind of come together. You don't see pluralism and civility on this list. Surprise, surprise. Major religious advocacy groups. This is based upon what roughly 900 religious leaders said. ACLU won't surprise you, NAACP, Interfaith Alliance, Bread for the World, Human Rights Campaign, and Sojourners were the top advocacy groups identified as. And you know what's interesting about all of these, roughly all of them, most of these, is that they cut across religious faith groups, right? They are, I mean, I guess NAACP is a little different, but the others, they're across religious lines.
Can I ask you, what are the initials NRLC?
You know, I had to check on that too, and now I'm trying to, I knew someone was going to ask me that. It's a pro-family group, and what does that actually mean? It's very similar to Focus on the Family. That's exactly what it is. National Right to Life Conference. That's exactly what it is. Thank you. And so we've got three very family, gender kinds of things here. Oh, well, four. Concerned Religion of America. And Christian Coalition. So this is like a political group, but these are all sort of connected. This is Dobson's group, Focus on the Family. Hasn't he left, or hasn't he turned that over to someone?
He's still
not gone.
He's in the process of, yeah. Yes.
When you started with these, you indicated it was a young man who was progressive and came with these listings. What would it be if there was a young or an older conservative person making a listing? Would they be the same or would they be different?
Well, I'd like to think they'd be the same. The sample here is roughly 900 religious leaders.
Yeah, this specific one doesn't have really a sense. The earlier ones where they were more issue-oriented instead of just listing a group.
That's right. They were asked, what groups represent you, or what are the ones that you think are most important for bringing about influence for your point of view?
Right.
And so you just had more votes on the progressive side for ACLU than you did Sojourners. And over here in NRLC. Now, I didn't realize this National Right to Life Committee or Conference Coalition, it just hasn't been on my radar. I mean, all these others I've heard about and know a little bit about. But apparently that's the group that most of the conservatives thought that could gain the most influence with.
Well, abortion is their top priority.
Yeah. But all these folks are concerned with abortion.
Yeah.
Huh? Want to talk about all these? Anyway. Yes.
What sociological influence did the use of nuclear weapons and these have on religion?
That's a good question. Well, I would rephrase the question just a little bit. I'd say what impact did that have on our thinking more generally? And I think there the answer would be that's the beginning of a groundswell of concern about the fact that we could literally annihilate ourselves as a species. So I think we're still living under that cloud, so to speak. Generally. Now, your questions about religion, I suppose that religious leaders have done a lot in addressing that, but I can't really speak to that, certainly with no specific data in mind.
Some people have said that it has decreased our respect for life, and the example given was the groundswell of support for the Iraqi war. You know, I mean, are we more warlike now than we were?
in the 1940s?
Don't I'd like to think we were less, but that David doesn't suggest it, does it?
No.
Yes?
Except for a few minority groups, the religious community has been dangerously silent on the nuclear issue.
And it's
very sad.
Because you see the
National Right to Life, you never hear them talk about the nuclear issue.
Right.
And the same with, it's a huge, to me, it's a troubling statement about our faith and our religious community that isn't a huge focus.
I certainly agree.
Yeah.
But it's not clear to me why groups have not spoken out on that.
I know.
It would seem so obvious in a way, right?
Of course.
Yes.
Within the context of your studying what causes to change it, what influences all the fluidity, do you incorporate in that the concept of evolution of consciousness?
Well, I haven't, because I mean I'm fully aware of that mode of thinking. It's not one that I've been involved in terms of making use of in my own work. But every time I think I see a sign of evolution of consciousness, I then see a sign that makes me question whether there's much of an evolution. So. But I don't want to dismiss that line of work or line of thinking at all. But I guess I'm a bit suspicious of evolutionary models.
But in terms of spirituality, they say it's often a paradox. When something like that happens, one consciousness rises, also great crises come with it. A lot of very horrible things happen concurrently that might make it look like, oh gosh, consciousness is rising, but it's actually one of those paradoxes.
Right.
The more consciousness rises, the more maybe the views of the conservatives will get entrenched because they resist change, and that will cause great friction with the opposing current.
Well, you may be onto something. I think with consciousness, evolution of consciousness, you have to have in mind a long span of time.
Exactly.
Things don't change quickly in consciousness. I mean, some things can, but in terms of some evolution,
500 years.
Oh yeah, it's. So we always stand, I think, too close to make very good judgments about those things to whatever's happening in our own time. Let's see.
Steve, I'm standing too close. Like, you're at the university. As I listened to the whole presentation, I got thinking to myself, if I was the university student sitting here, would that be my peers' response to all of this? In other words, all the surveying that was on the 206 to 209, was that predominantly the 40, 30, 40, 50, 60, 70 year old responding to it versus, versus the college level that's now going to be coming into and setting the tone for the next generation?
Well, of course, there would be very few college students in a national sample.
I realize that. You're at the university.
But theoretically, 18 years and older were included in any of these samples, but still you get very few. Now you're basically asking someone, what's the college generation's outlook?
Yeah.
It's your field and it's your student.
Yeah, it's very, but it's the hardest group to generalize about, believe me. It's quite a mix from one extreme to the other. It's not a good day to ask me that question because I'm kind of down on my class. And
that probably says a lot about the
reality.
I've got this big lecture class of 124 students, and I go there and there's only 80 present. I want to say, where the hell are the rest of you? But as I say that, I've got a portion of people in there that I'd really go to bat for too, and have great confidence in.
Yeah.
engaged. I think the thing that at the university that has revitalized me the most in terms of confidence in my students is this program we started with the CAP Center on internships here in Santa Barbara. And this is our third year doing it. We select 10 each year because we pay them a modest $2,000 to cover their transportation expenses and whatnot. Because it's a year-long program. And I've been so impressed. I am so impressed with the students that apply for this. We get about 30 to 40 applicants for these 10 positions. And the 10 that went out on this are just, I mean, you know, they were doing voluntary things in the sixth grade or something. I mean, they started very early in junior high and high school, and some have been already gone abroad and done things. And of the 30 students that come this year that we've had, five of them have already going or have gone to Teach for America. Three have gone to the Peace Corps. So it's. That social service, help humanity thing is there. And that gives me encouragement. Mm-hmm. Now, for every 30 I can point to like that, I know there's 300 that I can't include. But has that changed a lot? I don't know. What I find is that today's students, there's a kind of a latent sense of I'd like to do something, but they don't quite know how to connect and get going with it. And so what we've tried to do with the CAP Center internship program is to provide a venue, a way. Here's a nonprofit out there would love to have you come spend the year with them. Does this fit your interest? And so it's a matching thing. Can we match where you are and what you're interested with? You know, we got 2,200 nonprofits in Santa Barbara. There are more nonprofits in Santa Barbara than any other city the size of the United States. It's huge. So if we can show them the connection, here's the venue, many of them are going to get excited and go and really get turned on by this. So that's very encouraging. Yes.
When you talk about the future of religion, if you take the 20 to 30 year old, how many of them find religion relevant in their life at all?
Yeah, that's a very impossible question to answer.
Repeat the question, please.
She's asking among the 20 to 30 year olds, how many of them find religion relevant in their lives? You know, that age has always sort of been, at least in the American spirit, identified as kind of a dormant stage for religion. Other things are going on. And so, but those are the people who also come back and get involved in things that are religious or religious-like. And I think a lot of students today are looking for something that's a little bit less pious, less explicitly religious, but yet gives them a chance to do something that would be deeply meaningful, spiritual for them. So if you spread that definition of religion to its broadest, I think you capture many of them, particularly as they, you know, move in toward the 30s and they get married and have children and have to worry about paying rent and things like that. Yeah.
I just thought I'd make a little comment. My husband is a large Catholic family, and out of 10 kids, 7 are conservatives, 3 are progressives. Of the conservatives, the parents all line up with all these values, but their children, I would say 99% are all on the progressive side. And during the last election, those children influenced half of those parents to vote Obama, usually the wife, the mother. Father stuck to the conservative, but I thought that was very interesting, the dynamic of the, and they're college level kids, you know, how the dynamics changed because of the children's influence. So
well, that's fascinating. Where are they with respect to Sarah Palin? She came pretty close yesterday to saying that she just might run for president.
I'm here in Tremblay, and I'd like to make just an observation. I identify myself as being pretty much down the left of the progressive list. I was born, when I turned 10 years old, in August of 1945, that's when two nuclear weapons, atomic bombs, were dropped in Japan. Mm-hmm. I'm 75 years old now. For 65 years, there has not been any use of nuclear weapons, and there has not been another world war. The question I ask is, could it be possible that nuclear weapons have served as a deterrent? When I was 10 years old, there were tens of millions of men and women in the service. Million man armies were not uncommon. Today, they're a rarity because their existence is made unnecessary and unrealistic because of the presence of nuclear weapons. Has the horror of nuclear weapons been so strong that we now recognize that war is no longer possible?
Switch to terror.
65 years would suggest that so.
Well, I guess an impossible question to answer. I fear we really don't have it contained. So I tend to think it has not been much of a deterrent. Maybe short term deterrent, but the weapons are there, and they're getting into the hands of more and more new countries. I think our great fear is those weapons getting into the hands of militant groups, and then there's no way of containing that. We can contain governments at least a little better than we can contain radical militant groups.
But it's a moral question of why should we have them? They are capable of destroying, massive amounts of humanity. And why morally?
Why should we have them at all?
My answer to that is that the bombing of Dresden and the firebombing of Tokyo were more horrific. There were more lives lost in the firebombing of Tokyo with conventional weapons, and the firestorm that was deliberately caused on Dresden, which was not a military target, and was kept secret for something like 10 to 15 years after the war. Conventional weapons can do just as much damage.
Well, obviously, as Sherman said, war is hell, right? So war of any kind is hell. Yeah. We've got a treaty we're trying to get through with the Russians, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It's not trying to get through with the Russians, trying to get through with the Republicans.
Well, to the Republicans, to the Russians, that's right. Well, you would think there'd be just a groundswell of approval or concern or interest in doing that. But, you know, politically, if you can delay it, you do something.
I wonder if we could expand the concept of questioning authority and questioning tradition. It's not just a matter of religion. I'm thinking today on NPR there was a description of how the institution of marriage itself has diminished greatly since the mid-1950s or something. Apparently there was, 72% of all adults were married. When you come now to our own time, it's down 50% or below, or something like this. Is marriage something that is institutionally challengeable the way everything else seems to be?
I would say so. It appears to be. The data you cite suggests. What we do know is there is a growing, although still relatively small, proportion people who never marry.
Yeah.
It's up around 16% now. Never marry. That has gradually gone up. I think, but the major story there, it seems to me, is that marriage and family take many different forms and structures. And that's the big change. So that the husband-wife family of the 1950s, marriage of the 1950s, has become less and less prominent, and we've got more diverse forms of marriages and relationships and etc. So, you know, mother-only families and some father-only families, few, and all these families that are blended together from previous marriages and whatnot. So, I think the thing you can say that hasn't gone away is sex.
That's probably going to be the line everybody remembers.
Don't. Oh, is this going to be on? Is this on? This discussion is not on your website.
You're getting me
on. That's another problem with all this technology now. You know, I have grandchildren, 5 granddaughters, one little grandson, 5 granddaughters, and the oldest one is 17. And I said, you be careful. She said, Facebook stuff, you know, like a couple of kids. I said, you be careful about the pictures that end up on there. You never know, you know. You're 31 and you decide to build your school board someday. And they're going to bring up your little picture. So, but that's the thing. Anything you say or pictures or whatever now, you they're there for
forever.
Yeah.
I'm still. I'm going to get back to this theme of mine on the on that 20-year-old student, that university student. So, but look at it from a different way. Our society is greatly impacted by a half a dozen corporate media. I mean, corporates that control all of the media, and that's what we're fed all the time. But that age group isn't watching or reading the corporate thing. They're getting their information pretty much
on internet,
which doesn't yet have, you know, a corporate ownership to it. So again, because of your field, projecting that out a bit, are we going to have a more free thinking, less corporate dominated mindset from that generation than we have from ours? That's kind of always given a line over and over.
Well, it's a good question, but I think as they move out and into jobs and careers, that the corporate mindset will increase.
Yeah.
So I don't think there's going to be a huge difference. Now, the thing that bothers me about the internet is that there is no way to sort out what's reliable in terms of facts and what is just plain ideological driven facts. You know, it's like Fox News or whatnot. So, and in MSNBC. So, and the students don't have a good critical capacity to sort out. So I have them do research papers, and now nobody wants to go to the library. They always want to go to the internet, pull out something, and I say, but you've given me some data or some interpretation straight off of that website. You know who actually that supports, what group owns that, or what? And it's, oh no, it's like all are equal. Mm-hmm. No, they're not all equal. And so as we move more and more into this democratized news and democratized venues of information, how are we going to have a critical capacity to discern the truthfulness and factuality of information? And that's where I see a serious flaw in our education with students. But I don't know how to handle it. I don't really know how we do this successfully, but it's a real concern. But it's a concern really that faces all of us, because so much of the stuff, and some of it is, you know, on the internet, looks like it's coming from a good source. It's certainly well presented and all of that. And yet, you just don't know. And just as much as our religion is shaped by connections with ideologies, so much of the stuff on the websites are driven by certain sets of values and perspectives. So If you think about it, we got all this warfare of ideology and different perspectives and values just kind of floating through our media, and we're out there trying to arbitrate what we hear and see and make some sense of it. It's a tough task.
This morning we were reading LA Times, and it noted that the fluidity of religion with Bristol Palin and Dancing with the Stars, and he was hysterical, but you know, people's response to even that, how it's, you know, crossing over, what does that really mean? You know,
you mean the religious conservatives like this?
Yes, and it's amazing. And people on the Twitter were like twittering back and forth, and not that I'm doing that, but we're reading about it. And somebody took a gun and shot their TV.
Yeah, I read that.
Only
seen
one of the bunch.
Yes.
Well, yesterday was a report on an appearance by Bill Nye, the science guy, and he tripped, I guess, and I don't know, he was unconscious on the stage as he came out to make a presentation, and all the kids in the audience were twittering what the situation was. Nobody approached him to talk.
Oh,
so that's what scares me. So we are in communication. Well, we're not in communication. We're not connecting.
Well, hey, I speak to 125 kids three times a week, and half of them are twittering as I talk. So I've been tempted to. This is going to sound kind of. Is this still on? I mean, I've been tempted to smash a cell phone in my bathroom. I can't get away with it, you know. But they hide their cell phones behind a book.
Yeah.
And not only that, it's morally, it's morally hypocrite. That I'm reading a book while you talk. Reading my messages on cell phone. So I find myself now kind of walking through my class as I talk and saying, what's going on there, you know? And it's obnoxious, but I get really irritated that our class is just 50 minutes, you know? Can't you leave that thing alone for 50 minutes?
Yeah.
You're driving and doing it.
Some teachers have incorporated Twitter in their teaching so that they are involved as Twitter participants. I know, I'm just saying, there's got to be a way to break through it.
I'm sure there is. I think I'm too close to retirement with the word. Next generation of faculty can learn about that.
Me too. Okay, thank you.
You're quite welcome.